On our agenda today, we have the Department of Health is going to present the governor's budget, and I'm hoping that we can get through that and have time. I really need us to have time for this committee to ask questions. As you've already learned, this is a committee with a lot of questions and lots of knowledge, and so if you can take no more than about half of the time for the budget presentation, then we would have the other half of the questions, and we're giving you the whole hearing this time because the commissioner's here, and I want to welcome you to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Commissioner Diane Mandernach, Commissioner of the Department of Health, and I'm here today to discuss with you the funding priorities of the governor's budget as far as the Minnesota Department of Health is concerned. In a moment, I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Margaret Kelly to provide you with the detail of the request that we have. But first, I want to highlight a couple of the initiatives. You may recall when we were here a few weeks ago, we talked about the mission of the department, which is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. When you listen to the recommendations that we have today, we believe that they will very much assist us in carrying out that mission, particularly in ensuring a healthy start for our newborns, improving access to health care in rural and underserved areas, and addressing the incidence of infectious disease. The first priority that I want to talk about is that of pandemic influenza preparedness. The threat of pandemic influenza continues. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when and how severe. Many of the characteristics of the current H5N1 virus that is circulating throughout the world are similar to the 1918 virus, and that's what causes the national and international concern. We know that being prepared is our only defense against a disease for which we have very limited prevention strategies and treatment protocols. A year ago, I came forward with a request, a proposal, and the legislature awarded us a $5 million one-time money. So why do we need to continue to address this issue? Because the threat of a pandemic really does continue. We've got much more work to do to be prepared. We need to ensure that we have sufficient antiviral medication for 25% of our population. We need to ensure that we have 24/7 capability of response in our laboratory and our epidemiologists. We also need to exercise our plans, and we really cannot underestimate that. Every time we do an exercise, we have an opportunity to see what we maybe have forgotten, to tweak the plan accordingly, to go back, to test it again, to try it again. We also have to make sure that our local partners and their partners that they have at the local level in the community are testing and exercising and prepared. We know that all emergencies are local, and communities do need to be working hard to be prepared, and they are. The second priority that I want to highlight is our disease surveillance modernization proposal. The introduction of...
If I can interrupt, I'm sorry, just for a second. Wondering if you happen to have the budget pages that you're referring to, that would be very helpful as we go along. And maybe you can.
And Margaret?
She can go back and find those. I'm just thinking it'll be helpful to the committee because what we have in front of us is the governor's budget going forward, but it would be helpful, I think, for people to be able to look what was in those.
And Madam Chair, that's what Margaret will be doing when she comes and starts testifying. I'm just kind of laying out the 50,000 foot level.
All right.
The second priority that I want to highlight then is our disease surveillance. As we look at health information technology, it is very much changing the face of healthcare. The state health department has to be modernizing also, and so that we have real-time communication with our partners throughout the state. Our disease surveillance modernization proposal provides and ensures the interoperable systems at the state health department. We know that this will provide for better health protection for all Minnesotans. And the final proposal I want to highlight before I turn it over to Margaret is our laboratory operations proposal. Our public health lab is one of the finest in the country, and I certainly want to extend an invitation to the committee to come in to visit and to see the work that is done at the lab. What this proposal does It ensures that the basic needs of the lab, the equipment, the supplies, the safety systems, the staff, are in place to run it. I've only highlighted a few of our proposals. The remaining initiatives are equally important in helping us carry out our mission and achieve the health outcomes that we are looking for all Minnesotans. And now I'll turn it over to Margaret Kelly, and she'll walk you through the details. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Margaret Kelly, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Health, and we are going to begin on page 13 of the document, the home visiting proposal. Before I go into this, I want to say you should have a number of handouts, a couple of background pieces where we felt the budget narrative didn't provide all the information we thought you would want as you consider the proposal. So we do have a number of handouts on home visiting, Minnenable, tuberculosis. We also have a document that's full of numbers, our tracking sheet that kind of breaks down on one page the detail for each budget proposal and how we intend to spend the resources we're asking for. And that's also for your reference as we move forward. So if we begin on page 13, our home visiting proposal. For at least 100 years, home visiting has been used as a public health strategy with a proven track record to improve the health and well-being of families. The current TANF-funded home visiting program is targeted to high-risk and high-stress families, including teen parents. Public health nurses provide assessments, support, referrals, education, and guidance to these families. We work with both parents in both the prenatal and postnatal period. The proven track record includes improved birth outcomes through reduced smoking and improved nutrition, reducing both preterm and low birth weight births. Improved maternal caregiving and reduced child abuse and neglect, decrease in childhood injuries, and improved well child care, including child and teen checkups and immunizations. I think there's a valuable story on the handout we provided, and I'd just like to take a second to read through it. A pregnant teen had a history of sexual abuse, low self-esteem, and a poor support system. She lived with the father of her baby in a poorly maintained rented home. The public health nurse made frequent visits over 18 months, providing prenatal and parenting education, promoting the importance of parent-infant attachment and the provision of a safe and nurturing environment for the baby, and providing support and referrals to various community resources. The teen entered counseling, delivered a healthy baby, graduated from high school, and after high school enrolled in a certified nursing assistant program. In addition, the public health nurse advocated for the family with the landlord, which resulted in him making the needed repairs to the home. This is just one of many positive outcomes we've experienced with our home visiting program. Currently, the health department has $4 million a year of TANF funds for home visiting, and this proposal would increase funding to $9.5 million by fiscal year 09. The funding is awarded to local public health agencies and tribal governments for home visiting programs. That's our home visiting proposal. If you'd like, Madam Chair, we can talk about, take questions as we go through, or just continue.
Why don't we go through it so that there's a plenty of time?
Certainly. The next proposal is on page 15. It's our Minnenable program. Minnenable is a statewide competitive grant program supporting communities that encourage postponing sexual involvement and promote abstinence until marriage. For the current grant cycle, fiscal years 2003 to 2007, 22 community grantees representing a diverse group of organizations and racial and ethnic populations provide curriculum, community events, and public awareness activities that support positive youth-based abstinence messages. Minnenable grantees include nonprofit organizations, local public health agencies, and school districts. Federal rule changes have resulted in the current Minnenable program no longer meeting federal funding requirements, and many of our grantees would not be eligible to apply for a revised program. The governor is recommending that we maintain our existing Minnenable curriculum, and he is replacing the loss of federal abstinence funding with TANF funds. And you should have included in the handout some details on who the grantees are and where they're located. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 16. It's our fetal alcohol spectrum disorder proposal. Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders, or FASD, is an umbrella term describing the range of effects that can occur in an individual whose mother drank alcohol during pregnancy. These effects may include physical, mental, behavioral, and learning disabilities, which can last a lifetime. FASD is entirely preventable. Alcohol use is much more prevalent in pregnancy than the use of other substances. 62% of women of childbearing age in Minnesota are current drinkers, and at least 12% of pregnant women in Minnesota report that they drink alcohol. The governor is recommending that the current $1.1 million grant program to the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome be increased to $2 million annually to increase their efforts around prevention and intervention and public awareness and diagnostic services. This proposal is funded with general fund dollars. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 56, I believe. And it's in our Environmental Health Division. It's our state well program maintenance. It's the first of one of three proposals we have to adjust fee programs we have at the department. And before I begin talking about it, I'd kind of like to take a minute for the benefit of new members and talk about the principles and guidelines we follow at Department of Health with our fee programs. The Commissioner of Health is charged with regulating a wide variety of activities, literally from birth to death. And in many cases, it makes sense that the regulated entity fund our regulatory activities. Our first principle is that, or our first guideline is that fee revenue is not dedicated to the department. We deposit all of our fee revenue into the state government special revenue fund. We in turn receive a direct appropriation from this fund to support the regulatory work we do. This is the first way in which the legislature has review of and authority over our level of spending in regulatory programs. The second guideline is that fee programs strive to be self-supporting. Department of Finance policy and state statutes direct us to set fees at a level that does not significantly over or under recover costs. We keep track of revenues and expenditures for each fee program to ensure that they are in balance. The Department of Finance prepares a biannual report on fees statewide. It's called the Departmental Earnings Report, and it was released within the last week. This report is another way that the legislature reviews fees set by state agencies. Finally, fees are reviewed annually. We review fees, revenues, and expenditures on an annual basis to ensure that we are not over or under collecting. We make adjustments to our spending annually to ensure our expenditures do not exceed revenues if possible. The Department of Finance policy and state statutes direct us to evaluate our fees over a five-year time frame, the current year, 2 years prior, and 2 years into the future. Because of this, we recommend adjustments to a number of fee programs each biennium. And prior to recommending a change, we consider our statutory responsibilities, the appropriate level of spending for the activity, potential efficiencies we can achieve, and consumer expectations around the services we provide. Finally, the legislature reviews all fee changes, including new fees. Statute requires that any increase, decrease, or new fee be brought before the legislature for approval. So we have three proposals. The first one is the state well program maintenance recommendation on page 56. And our well management program protects the health of Minnesotans who drink well water by assuring the proper construction of new wells and the proper sealing of old wells. The program is funded entirely by fees that are established in statute, and fees have historically been raised every 4 years to support the program activity. Most fees are one-time fees collected only when a regulatory activity occurs. Moderate fee increases were approved during the 2005 legislative session, and they were just implemented in fiscal year 2007. But the recent reversal in the real estate market is now wiping out most of the expected revenue increase. The program has placed hiring freeze on all non-critical positions, and we will be pursuing other cost-saving measures, but these will still be inadequate to fund essential program functions. The governor is therefore recommending that we increase some fees that support the well management program, most notably increasing the well construction notification and permit fees from $175 to $215, the well sealing fee from $35 to $50, and the well disclosure fee made at property transfer from $40 to $45. These fee increases are proposed for implementation in fiscal year 2009 to continue to operate the well management program at current levels. We are not proposing to increase our appropriation at this time. And when we compare our current fees with those fees charged by local units of government where they have delegated authority, we find that our fees, as we're recommending the increase, are right in line with what local units of government are charging. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 58, tuberculosis prevention. TB cases are rising in Minnesota. There were 216 in 2006 and only 199 in 2005. 82% of new cases are occurring among foreign-born immigrants and refugees. More than half of Minnesota counties have had a case of TB in the last 5 years, and the rate of TB in Minnesota is approximately 2.5 times that of its bordering states. 11% of Minnesota cases are in children under the age of 15 years. Children are more likely to develop serious illness requiring hospitalization. Drug-resistant TB is a major problem. This last year, Minnesota had a case of extensively drug-resistant TB. This person was resistant to 12 of 14 drugs. Extensively drug-resistant TB has a mortality rate of 33% and is expected to increase. 17% of cases in Minnesota are resistant to at least one drug. The proportion of multi-drug-resistant TB in Minnesota is double the national average. Medication for a simple case of TB costs $800, while multi-drug resistance can exceed $25,000 per case. Curing and preventing TB saves money and reduces health care costs. Preventing a case of multi-drug-resistant TB can save up to $137,000 in medical costs alone. And treating infected persons before they develop active TB is simpler, less costly, and safer for the patient and their community. Current funding that we have at the Department of Health is insufficient to meet the need for medication, lab testing, and case management. This proposal will increase funding for those three purposes: an additional $200,000 for TB medication, an additional $252,000 for TB laboratory testing, an additional $200,000 in grants to local public health agencies to support their case management efforts. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 60, our public health laboratory operations proposal. We began moving into our new state-of-the-art laboratory in the fall of 2005. Shortly after this, we realized that existing laboratory budgets were not sufficient to fully support the anticipated and unanticipated costs of operating the laboratory. The same was true for the Department of Administration, which operates and maintains all the buildings on the Capitol complex. This proposal has two components. The first is lease rates charged by the Department of Administration. Lease rates to the Health Department include gas and electric costs, maintenance and security staff, and other operating costs. The Department of Administration first estimated their costs of maintaining our new laboratory prior to the construction of the building. There was not a similar state facility to base their estimates on. And since that time, actual costs have far exceeded their estimates. Lease rates for the lab building will increase by over 22% next fiscal year. We have worked with the Department of Administration over the past few months to identify efficiencies in operation that could reduce their expenses as well as ours. But these changes will only impact future lease rates. This proposal includes $1.3 million over the next biennium to pay the increased lease rates charged to the Department of Health by the Department of Administration. The second component of this proposal is to cover increased operating costs that the Department is directly responsible for: laboratory equipment and supplies, maintenance agreements on new, highly technical equipment, air handling and water purification systems, and modifications to lab space. Our operations changed in several ways when we moved into our new building. Some of our equipment was too old to move, and we needed to purchase new. This added new maintenance agreement costs to our budgets. Another change was the laboratory support functions. We went from 2 floors of lab space to 3, which increased our need for supplies and technical support staff. Another change was the highly specialized air and water filtration systems. These systems are incredibly efficient but require additional staff and funding in order to maintain them. This proposal includes just under $1 million over the next biennium to cover these added costs to the Department of Health. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 62. It's our newborn screening program. This is the second of our three fee proposals. The newborn screening fee covers the cost of screening approximately 72,000 babies born in Minnesota each year for 53 rare, heritable, and congenital medical conditions, conditions that are present at birth. Screening costs include laboratory staff, laboratory supplies, laboratory equipment, and maintenance. The fee also covers the cost of follow-up to assure infants are immediately connected with specialty care. The fee was last increased in 2003 from $21 to $61 in anticipation of increasing the number of disorders screened from 5 to 53. We made these changes based on recommendations of the Newborn Screening Program Advisory Committee and review of the legislation. This proposal simply ensures sufficient revenues and resources are available to support the ongoing cost of testing and follow-up of the 53 disorders. Without this fee adjustment and appropriation increase, the department would not be able to support screening for the full panel of disorders, significantly impacting the lives of many children and their families. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 64. It is our specimen handling fee increase. It's the final fee proposal we have before you. A relatively small percentage of diagnostic tests conducted by the public health laboratory are done for routine patient management, specifically TB and parasitic disease testing are two examples. In 1979, the legislature created a $15 specimen handling fee to recover some of the costs of this type of testing. The fee has not been increased since that time, yet inflation has increased our costs. This proposal simply increases the fee from $15 to $25 to help offset some of those costs, and we're also proposing a corresponding increase in our appropriation. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 65, Pandemic Influenza Preparedness. The threat of pandemic influenza, as the Commissioner stated, continues to challenge the state's capacity to respond to public health emergencies. On page 65 of the budget document, there is a chart that illustrates the challenges our current capacity faces. For example, a hospitalization rate of 1% to 10% of cases would translate into 15,000 to 172,000 patients when we only have 16,000 licensed beds and 4,700 estimated surge capacity beds. Assuming an 8-week pandemic, we would need 8 million N95 masks, and we currently have only 290,000 in our state stockpile. This proposal has several components. The first is a healthcare supply stockpile. Personal protective equipment such as N95 masks will be essential to healthcare workers. Alternate care sites will require supplies during the course of the pandemic. $10 million this biennium is proposed to kickstart the stockpile, and $2 million per year is recommended for ongoing expansion and management. The second component is antiviral medication stockpile. Minnesota is eligible to purchase antivirals off of a federal contract. They have discounted the cost of these antivirals by 25%. A one-time amount of $5 million is requested to reach the recommended 25% coverage of our population to ensure that we have sufficient antivirals for 25% of our population. The third component is the Minnesota Department of Health capacity that we need to respond to emergencies. Our public health laboratory needs to be operational for 24/7 response capacity to provide specialized testing. Our epidemiology staff need to have 24/7 response capacity to investigate potential cases and respond to the limits of the outbreak. We need to be doing planning and exercising around pandemic influenza and health emergency preparedness in general. In order to manage a response, we need to do ongoing exercising of our plans to ensure that the plans and the protocols will work during a catastrophic event. We need to do some healthcare system training before and during an event to increase the safety of patients, family, and staff. We are requesting financial resources and to support FTEs to do this work. The fourth component is working with our local partners, preparing communities to respond. Local public health agencies and tribal governments will help slow the spread of the virus and care for a massive number of ill people. They will distribute vaccines 6 to 9 months after the pandemic begins. A formula grant program would provide $1 million to local public health agencies and tribal governments each year. The next proposal, Madam Chair, is on page 94, our disease surveillance modernization proposal. As the private sector invests millions of dollars in developing and implementing electronic records management systems, they are growing increasingly frustrated with the public sector's lack of capacity to electronically exchange data. The state invested resources in health information technology in rural and underserved communities last legislative session, and the governor is proposing to continue that investment over the next 3 years as well. Without a similar investment in state systems, the health department will be asking providers to fax or mail to us information that they can share electronically among themselves. This lack of capacity at the state makes for a very resource-intensive process for providers and could lead to the delay of critical infectious and chronic disease reporting. We're proposing to modernize our disease surveillance systems at the state so that we achieve the following goals. First, compliance with national standards and requirements. State health departments will need to be compliant with standards proposed by the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, similar to HIPAA requirements imposed on healthcare providers. Second, we want a standardized and secure electronic exchange of disease information between providers, local health departments, the states, and the CDC. Third, we want to improve monitoring, analysis, and reporting of disease data throughout the state. The electronic exchange will allow MDH to report back to local public health agencies, something we are not currently able to do. And finally, we want to improve response to outbreaks and incidents and trends in disease. We have many aging surveillance systems at the department, and this proposal will focus on our two largest systems, our infectious disease reporting and our cancer surveillance system. The final proposal, Madam Chair, that we have before you today is on page 97, the compensation adjustment. Each year, compensation costs rise due to a variety of factors, negotiated bargaining agreements, increases in health insurance rates and workers' comp insurance, to name just a few. These increases occur regardless of the funding available in agency budgets. This past fiscal year, these cost pressures reflected a 3.5% increase in compensation costs for the Department of Health. The governor is recommending increasing agency budgets for salary-related costs by 2% to offset the anticipated increases in the coming biennium. Absent this proposal, agencies would have to absorb these increases in their existing budgets. This would affect all of our direct appropriated funds, our general fund, state government special revenue fund, and healthcare access fund appropriations. And, Madam Chair, that concludes my overview, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Okay, committee members, now have a chance to ask questions, and we'll start with Representative Madore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I'm going to ask you to go back and help me understand something here. I'm talking about the Men Enable program. About 2 weeks ago, you were here, and you talked to us about family planning, and we had some documentation that said that there was a $6 million gap between the number of women that you were able to serve versus the number of women who were actually eligible for the program. And now you come before us today with a program that you're willing to take TANF dollars for, and TANF dollars, my understanding, and according to this, is temporary assistance for needy families to support this ENABLE program, and yet you're not willing to use those same dollars to go back and do pregnancy prevention programs. So I'm having a real problem here with understanding the priorities of the governor. It's okay to take TANF dollars that help families perhaps pay an unexpected bill so that they can take care of their children, stay in their homes, they can Those funds are needed to supplement an emergency situation in a family, and the governor is saying it's okay to take $1 million of that fund and use it towards this program, and yet we're not addressing the $6 million gap in that pregnancy prevention program. So can you explain that to me? Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative, the governor's recommendation is specific to the Men Enabled program, and we've had a successful program for a number of years. And absent this proposal, we would likely lose that component of our comprehensive family planning strategy. The gap that you mention in the family planning program, I'm not certain of the specifics of that amount, but what we're looking at with family planning right now is not only the Minnesota Department of Health Family Planning Grant Program, but also the what's been referred to as the 1115 waiver at the Department of Human Services. This is a waiver that was granted to Minnesota, a waiver to our Medicaid program that would allow us to reimburse providers for eligible participants for family planning services provided at clinics around the state. And that program was intended to expand and build upon the capacity of the Health Department's grant program. And at the time the legislature directed the Department of Human Services to seek that federal waiver, it was anticipated that that would replace the need for a grant program at the Department of Health. The waiver was just implemented. I think it's only been implemented for a number of months. It's not even fully implemented as we envisioned it. And we anticipate that it's going to take another year or two to reach that full implementation stage and to work with providers to fully understand how they can take advantage of this program and what impact it's going to have on family planning services around the state. The governor's recommendation for MinEnable addresses a specific need. We don't know how the 1115 waiver is yet going to impact family planning services, and we wanted to take more time to understand that before we recommend additional funding in this area. One of the benefits, if I could add, one of the benefits to the 1115 waiver is that the feds pay 90% of the cost, and so it's a significant financial savings for the state in the delivery of family planning services.
Madam Chair?
Senator.
But didn't you tell us during the presentation that this program was no longer eligible for federal funding? That's why we had to go to TANF to support the MinEnable program? I thought that's what I heard. So this program will never be eligible for any federal funding. Is that what you're... Am I not understanding
Madam
that?
Madam Chair and Representative, no. Our current MinEnable program is not eligible for federal abstinence education grant. We could change our program so it would be eligible, but the governor's recommending that rather than doing that, we replace the federal dollars with other resources.
I guess my problem, Madam Chair, is that we're taking money away from families with identified need that have a temporary situation. TANF dollars are so scarce, and we're willing to take $1 million out of that program to fund something that is not eligible for federal reimbursement. And what exactly would we need to do to make this program eligible for federal dollars?
Madam Chair and Representative, the TANF funds are, as I understand them, there's a balance of funds that would not, absent this proposal, would not be used for healthcare programs. As the governor evaluated all of the programs that could be funded with TANF funds, the governor made the decision that this was a high priority for the use of TANF funds. If we needed to change our MinEnable program to be compliant with federal requirements, we would have to do away with the current curriculum that we have. Right now, the Department of Health reviews and approves all of the curriculum that is out there. New federal requirements would simply allow any curriculum to be adopted by any program and be eligible for MinEnable funding.
But, sorry, Madam Chair, can I just...
Senator?
Okay, what it sounds like is that this is a pet project of the governor's, that the federal government has set guidelines for these programs, and the governor is making a decision that he's not going to allow curriculums that he's not comfortable with to be taught with this. So instead, he's using TANF dollars that my county tells me they are running short every year, and they are unable to serve the families that come to them that need this funding. So he's taking these dollars and he's applying it to a PEP program that is never going to receive federal authorization for any kind of reimbursement. I really want to know specifically what curriculum he's not willing to address in this program to make it eligible for federal dollars.
Madam Chair, Representative, I cannot speak to whether or not this is a PEP project of the governor, nor can I speak to what your county's needs around TANF are. But I can tell you that the governor determined that this to be a priority of funding of his, and I can provide you with the specific differences between our curriculum and that's being recommended by, required by the federal government.
Madam Chair, I would like to get that documentation, and I'd like to ask that we get further explanation, because again, I'm not asking you to justify my county's position. I can tell you just from experience in the past 3 years that I've been a part of the community services programs in my county, every year they are running short in this program. Every year they run at a deficit, and I am very concerned about taking $1 million from programs that are already established and dumping it into a program like this. If this is something the governor feels so strongly about, perhaps it should be a general fund expenditure and not an expenditure taking money away from needy families. And I guess I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you. And I think if you can make that document available to all the committee, that would probably be a good idea. All right. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 68, you talk about the training for healthcare workers for a pandemic and influenza. Episode. Is it in process of being done, or have we done any small training sessions with counties throughout the state, or is this being prepared? The money that you're asking for, is that something that's going to be looked at in 2007, 2008, or what's the scenario with that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can speak a bit to that. We have ongoing training with our hospital partners, along with our public health partners, and the extended community partners, so that this is not just a health issue. It gets into emergency management, and so the training and exercising that is going on has been going on, I would suggest, for the last year and a half, 2 years. And in the course of that time, we have top to bottom at the individual level, as well as all the way up to the various levels of the federal government assisting us. We are probably close to about 5,000 exercises. And so it's at all levels that training is going on. What we need to do is to ensure that the dollars are there to continue that process. And so it's not just, we're not done yet, and I don't know that we will ever be done. But that's where we're looking at.
Gotcha. Mr. Nelson?
Commissioner, you said the federal government. Is the federal government putting money into this training to help out with this, or is there a limitation on what the feds are going to help out with, or is it kind of left up to the states to do all this?
Madam Chair, Representative, the federal government is assisting. There is our grant funding has been cut, I believe, about 10 to 12%, and so, but it is also very restrictive. It's very categorical in terms of what you are able to use it for. So we do get help from the federal government. Some of that goes in toward a national stockpile that has Minnesota's name on it, so to speak, that we can draw down in the event we need to, but it does not fully address the issues that are needed regarding the citizens of the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a little bit to Representative Medora's point on the Men Enable program, and if Commissioner, you want to jump in at any point at this time. I substitute teach on the side and was able to go to one of these health classes that had the abstinence first curriculum in it, and it was it was very refreshing to have someone in the classroom who was actually advocating for abstinence vice the sexual education program that we have in our public education institutions to create some alternatives. And I think you see some of the implications of that on the graph that has been handed out here under the ENABLE program. From 1992 to 2004, there's some significant reductions in the birth rate of teen pregnancies because of implementation of this program. And I think those are some of the things we need to look at in this committee, or what are the causal effects? Instead of treating the disease, let's treat what's causing the disease here. And I think the ENABLE program is one of those programs that really gets to the core of this issue. So if you take a look down at point two here, it says teen birth rates have declined 28% between that time, saving the taxpayer $72 million. It's a program that actually has some benefit that we can sink our teeth into and say, if we continue to press this program, we are making advances, particularly in the teen pregnancy in the state, and I would fight vehemently to keep this program in place, whether it's general funding, TANF dollars, or whatever, because I think we're treating the disease rather than treating the symptoms. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, just a couple comments. I think it's very important that we not jump to cause and effect relationships. There could be also all kinds of other contributions to the declining sexual activity and teen birth rates, not just this program. And I do have a question for the Assistant Commissioner. You were talking earlier in your presentation about the MinEnable program. The grants extending over 4 years, I believe you said. Is that typical? I mean, I've received some criticism about these, what's it called, the Family Planning Special Projects grant process being extended over a long, or only one round of grants occurring over a four-year period. And it sounds like that's what you were saying for the MinEnable program also. Is that typical? I guess I would have thought it would be every biennium. And specifically with the Family Planning Special Grants Project, or Special Projects Grant, I understand you're coming to an end point in that process, and doesn't that grant process have to be started 6 months or so in advance so that applicants have enough time to prepare grants? Could you comment on all that?
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Trump.
Kelly.
We tend to award grants, competitive grants, either 2 year or 4 year cycles. And typically when we start up a grant program, we award grants on 2 year cycles. And as grant programs become longer term and more stable, we tend to migrate towards 4 year cycles. Awarding grants on a competitive basis is a time consuming process, and that's not that we're trying to avoid that work. But it does, as you stated, require 6 to 8 months, sometimes a year, of advance work. So as the current family planning grant program cycle winds down, and as the MinEnable grant program winds down, we are already winding up our process of awarding the next round of grants.
Madam Chair, if I can
just...
But will that process take place such that there's continuity in the Family Planning Special Projects grant thing, or is there going to be a time when there's no money going out for family planning because the grant process hasn't started early enough?
Madam Chair, Representative, our goal is that we will have completed our process and notified grantees and award the grants on the 1st of January, when the previous grants ended on the 31st of January. So our goal is that there would be no gap in funding for those grantees that are awarded a second round in the next round.
And so it's January to January and not July to July?
Madam Chair, Representative, depending on the grant program, we typically do award grants on a January to January basis because that works well with the fiscal year of our grantees.
Okay. Thank you.
I had a question, and I just want to go back for a moment while we're on the MinEnable program. I asked a question of one of your staff, and I don't see that person here, but it goes, I think, to the comment that Representative Severson was making, and the comment from Representative Schumper, which is, what are the comparative benefits between the Mennonville program and other sex education programming that the department may or may not have been looking at. And I haven't heard a response back from that. I understand there was some sort of comparative analysis done, and it doesn't really tell us here anything about that. And so the cause and effect question is still up in the air, I guess, and I'm just wondering if you can shed any light on that today, or do I need to ask for it again?
No, Madam Chair, on the background information handout that we provided, on the back page is a paragraph talking about research and evaluation. And we did do an evaluation of our Men Enable program, and one of the more positive things that we learned through the evaluation is that during the time students were involved in the Men Enable curriculum, there was increased communication around talking about sex between parents and adolescents.
Thank you. I did read that, and that's valuable to know, and that's it's a good part of evaluation. But I think it doesn't speak to the question or the comment that was being discussed here by Representative Severson and Representative Shumper. In other words, cause and effect in terms of actual teen birth rate declining and what the graph shows. So,
Madam Chair, we have not been able to conduct the extensive sort of evaluation that would determine cause and effect. We're able to say that during the time of this program, this is what's been happening, and this is the funding level for the two programs, but we don't have the resources to conduct the type of evaluation that would provide you with that specific data.
So, you're saying that that's never been studied by the department in recent years, or?
Madam Chair, as far as I know, it has not.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, either one. I'm actually not going to talk about Mennonville, but I am looking at the funding of this, and I think I heard you say that the fees that are raised in this area or for these purposes they go into the general fund and don't always get reallocated to this need. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative, the funding for Mennonville, is that what you're referring to?
I think you had in your list of requests here for fee increases. And then I think you said, I'm listening, that fees in this area don't always necessarily get reinvested in the area that they were raised.
Madam Chair, Representative, the fees collected are deposited in a fund set aside specifically for fee revenue. And we then have an appropriation made out of that fund that corresponds to the revenue we collect. It's not a direct correlation all the time. Sometimes because we plan our fees over a four-year period of time, sometimes at the beginning we're collecting less than we need, than we're spending. Towards the end, or it's the flip side. At the beginning, we're collecting more than we're spending. At the end, we're collecting less than we're spending. It balances out over a four-year period of time. The fees are not dedicated to the department, but they are set aside in a separate fund. It is not the general fund. It's the state government special revenue fund. And appropriations are made out of that fund specifically for fee-related activities.
Okay. I'm just, in my world of high school textbooks, if a student loses a textbook, they pay a fee to the high school. That money gets put into the high school's operating budget. And then when it comes time to buy that textbook again, we have to fight interdepartmentally to get resources to replace that book. And so I'm kind of trying to figure out in my world how it computes to what you're talking about here. And I think that that's about the way it happens with you as well.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's similar and a little bit different in that the fees are not a part of, are not deposited into our operating fund, the general fund. They are set aside. And so if a student were to lose a book and pay a fee for that, that fee then would reimburse the school for the purchase of a new book in the future. And not, you wouldn't have to compete against that fee supporting the light bill versus purchasing a new book.
Thank you. Second question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm concerned with the direction that we're seeming to go in the fee increases. I guess the longer I'm down here now, a whole whopping 7 or 8 weeks here that we've been working on this stuff, I'm starting to get a picture that it seems like lower-income families, very extremely low-income families, get subsidies to help for things. Higher-end families, higher-income families don't mind paying the fees, but middle-class families, those fees don't fall proportionately to income. So I guess I'm concerned about middle-class families. I'm starting to see why middle-class families tend to carry the brunt of the tax burden, and I'm questioning some of the fees that we are bringing, and I guess I'll work through the committee process on that. But I just want to raise that awareness to you, and I'm sure you're aware of it. I just want to make that known that I think we need to look at a more progressive way of looking at providing these services. And I'm also very concerned about the idea that our budget in this area, health and housing, is like it's worse than the wild thing. And, you know, where we have 68% cuts in one area and 68% increases in another year, and I see this as more of a stable funding need, and I'm hoping that we can move in that direction in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson.
I'll pass it back.
Oh, okay. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, I understand that you haven't been able to, due to lack of resources, conduct the kind of research you need to find out the value of these programs. I think we're all value people. My family believes in value. I think we all believe in value. From everything I've seen and heard, the governor certainly believes in value. Do you think it would be beneficial to get that information, to see if we are indeed getting the value out of the taxpayer dollars that are being spent on the MinEnable program as compared to other programs with other curricula that could be used? Maybe to answer the question that Representative Shumper and Representative Severson seem perhaps to have a disagreement on. Would that be valuable?
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, Representative, as we put together proposals for grant funding or for new initiatives, we always try to build evaluation into a proposal. As a public servant, I think it's really important that we know what we're getting for the dollars we're investing, and I think evaluation is a very critical part of that. At the same time, as budgets get tight, the delivery of services typically take priority over the evaluation of those services. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not going to say one way or the other. It's just the fact of state budgets.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, I believe in good government, and I believe in value in our government and value for the taxpayers. So I guess my question is, there is some one-time money in the budget, and this ostensibly could be a good use for one-time money. So my question to you would be, how much would your department need to do the research? What kind of resources would we be talking about here to evaluate these programs, particularly in regards to other programs that may have equal success in other states or may have in the past had equal success in our states? What kind of resources would you be looking at as a department to conduct a good evaluation of that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we would have to get back to you on that in terms of figuring out what it would cost to evaluate a program like this.
I would appreciate your getting back to me on that, then. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, ready? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the point of the MinEnable, and I think, as I stated before, that I have been substitute teaching and heard, I also know some of the people that are volunteering in that particular program, and it is a volunteer program that uses a small subsidy to arrange for the administrative oversight of the particular program in the school's area. And if there's ever a program that leverages state dollars, this is it, because they have people who are very passionate about the message, and they are in the schools making a difference. And I guess when I was in the classroom itself, it was interesting to watch the students and the impact that that information had, because it was diametrically opposed to some of the other information, just the physical aspects of the sexual education, then going into the other emotional aspects of the act of intimacy. And so it was one of those things that I think strikes to the very issues that we're looking at in this graph that say, you know what, in order to give these kids the information they need to cope with this situation, we need to give them both sides of the argument. And I think that's what is so strong on the Enable. It's not just that it gives both sides of the argument, but it's also very heavily leveraged by volunteers in the local communities. And in that program, if we cut this funding completely, you're going to see that go away, and we will not have that voice out there. So I hope that we can have this discussion within the committee here on the merits of the program itself, and possibly even bring some people in to testify on that, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Shunker.
Madam Chair, to continue on this, the more I look at this graph on page 2 of the Mininable handout, I'm really bothered, despite your comments, that they seem to be making a cause and effect connection. There's all kinds of things that could have contributed to the reduction in sexual activity among teenagers, it seems to me. And secondly, in response to Representative Morgan's question, on the top of page 2, you mentioned an evaluation from 1998 to 2002. Do you think we could all get a copy of that evaluation?
Madam Chair, Representative, we will get a copy of that to you.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I think that's what I was asking for, too, what kind of research had been done on this, and if there was a comparison, and maybe I didn't ask the question right, I guess it would be very good if we could all see that document and look at it ourselves. That would be great.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, one of the things in this program is that it's really built on the idea of establishing self-esteem, the ability to say no, the ability to stay in charge of your personal behavior. And it certainly is on a continuum of tools, if you will, that you provide for young people. And one of the things that we've seen with individuals who have participated in this program is that it reflects into other aspects of their life. So while there is the whole aspect of sexual activity, it's not the only aspect where we see good results. We see it in the area of drug use. We see it in the area of other risk behavior, where individuals who have gone through this program feel a sense of personal self-esteem such that they make good decisions. So whether it's cause and effect or whether we just are raising or have the ability to impact self-esteem and give good tools to young people to make good health decisions, I think that's an aspect that needs to be looked at.
Thank you. Representative Madorin Lane.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to qualify or, again, express the issue here, and I was not commenting on the program or the effectiveness. The issue here is that you're taking TANF dollars, and the audience and the people on tape need to understand what those dollars are meant for, and it is not meant for an experimental program that does not meet federal government guidelines. It is meant to help families who need assistance. And that's what my issue is with this program. We can debate the merits of the program all we want. I certainly do not want to come off that I do not appreciate abstinence programs. My issue is that the governor is choosing to fund this program with TANF dollars. And I would like to see a better use of those dollars to go to the programs that are already established for families that need assistance. Thank you.
Representative Madorin, I'd also maybe just note to you that there are a number of other places in this budget where TANF dollars are being utilized, so you might want to take a look at those too, if that's your issue, that's the issue that you're trying to talk about. Okay, Representative Lane.
I certainly would be amongst those who would be supporting programs that raise self-esteem and provide for good decision-making and even provide for encouragement for abstinence in young people. However, when I look at this chart, I too am concerned about what's being said here, because this program started, I guess, in 1995, and yet the chart shows 1992 to 2004. Usually, if you're going to support the effectiveness of a program, you start when it starts, and you show the effect of it over time. So I would be more interested in showing this chart actually, not just a line drawn from one year picked for some reason to another year, but the ups and downs all through, so we might be able to see the more realistic reporting of what the students have reported in the Minnesota Student Survey. And I would agree with Representative Shumper that this doesn't necessarily mean cause effect. And I would also point out, it says significant disparities among racial and ethnic populations. That might be worthy of some discussion. To me, that would indicate that there are areas in our communities, groups in our communities for which this number does not go down and may in fact be increasing. It just simply says significant disparities among racial and ethnic populations. We need to do a lot more than simply fund programs that promote abstinence. We need to have abstinence as part of the programs that we support for sex education, and we need to not take resources that are needed for the whole population to support one idea.
Commissioner, just along that regard, I'm just wondering, in terms of this issue of disparities, does this graph throw everybody into the same graph? And do we find out, can you give us some information about what kind of programs do work better based on race? Or not as well? I mean, what do we know? Has that been evaluated? And I mean, now that we're talking about this graph, I think there's lots of questions that come forward, and I'm just wondering if you have graphed that racial disparity that is alluded to in the paragraph above.
Madam Chair, if I could speak to the graph for a second, and before I answer your question, I just want to state for the committee that we didn't put this graph in here to imply that the results on this graph are attributable to the Men-Enabled program, but simply as background information on what is happening around the teen pregnancy rate in Minnesota. We have not done, as I stated, the evaluation to draw that conclusion. But this graph does lump all of the racial and ethnic groups into two pinpoints on the graph. And we can provide the breakdown for you to show what the rate is by racial and ethnic group. I know that there's a much bigger gap among African-American teens than there is among, I think, any other group. And I don't know if we know what strategies are effective, and we'd have to get back to you on that.
I appreciate that. And is there, in other literature, an evaluation about what may work better in certain communities as compared to this program or any other program?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think when we start getting into our minority populations, we have our Office of Minority Health that has significant number of grantees, and some of those grantees are specifically addressing this issue. I can't tell you which populations, but we can get back to you on that. They have the information, they have the programs, and they would probably be the ones who are best at able to define what is working, because they would have the grantees' evaluations that they could relay that information to us.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, it sounds like there's enough interest in this. Maybe we should actually have a hearing on health disparities in general. I have actually a couple questions dealing with those that I'll hold off for just a few minutes. Representative Shumper?
Just one quick question. Is there a standardized curriculum for the Men-Enabled program? And if so, could you provide us with that?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, yes, we can.
Okay, thank you.
There is a standardized curriculum, is that what I heard?
Madam Chair, there are three approved curriculums.
Three approved standardized curriculum, okay. Representative Medor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to qualify or ask again that in addition to that, we get what the federal guidelines are in order for this program to qualify for dollars. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, we will do that.
I think that's all noted. I'm giving you some homework, Commissioner. Representative Prince?
I think it's short. Along to Representative Medora's question, let's assume that we use TANF dollars here. What areas that are currently funded by TANF dollars would get cut? And you may not know that right now, but I'm curious if you can provide that information for us as well. Because I'm assuming we're not raising money somewhere. We're just moving TANF dollars over to fill this need. And so if we move it here, it had to come from somewhere. So I'm curious if you can provide that information to us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we certainly can. My understanding is that there are not cuts that are being made in order to fund this activity out of TANF. TANF is a federal block grant, Temporary Assistance Community Families, that can be used by states for a list of activities. The primary use of TANF funds is our state MFIP program. There are other purposes for which TANF funds can be used, and Men-Enabled falls within that broad category of eligibility. There are a number of non-MFIP activities that are funded around the state, and the governor's proposal here reflects some rearranging of funding, and the extent to which there are reductions, I can't speak to that, but we can get back to you on that.
I just would like to know, I mean, because it sounds like I thought I'd track him here. I'm sorry if I a stupid question here, but this program is eligible for federal funding. And it would, so you're saying that if we could bring money in, more money would come into the state from the Fed? Or are you saying, no, we have this basket, and instead of putting that over here, we're going to put it here? So I want to know, I think I got my point to you, that I want to know if we're taking it from this area to put it here, what's being taken away from? I want to know the impact of what we do here. Thank you. You can give it to us later.
Okay. Representative Morgan?
Yeah, to that point, Madam Chair, thank you. One of the things that I think the public is clearly tired of is the shell game. And so I just want to make it very clear that Representative Madore said earlier that our county, the county that we both represent, runs out of TANF funds every year. I'm assuming that there is not a pot of gold left over in the TANF funds that this state receives from the federal government, that we are then saying, well, we can take $1 million of that and put it into this. I'm assuming that if $1 million is shifted, there's $1 million of spending on things that had been spent on before that would not be able to have that money spent on those things. And perhaps I'm just repeating what Representative Kranz said in maybe my stupid way, but do you see what I'm saying? I don't want to be thinking about this in terms of a shell game. I just want to be clear. Can you answer my question?
Madam Chair and members of
Kelly,
in my stupid way, I will do the best that I can to explain this to you, but I don't have the expertise in all of the ways in which TANF funds are used. I only know that we have a limited amount of TANF funds at the Department of Health, and that between the Department of Finance and the Department of Human Services and the Governor's Office, they reviewed statewide TANF funding and made recommendations based on what was available in our federal grant. The extent to which other programs, how all those changes occurred, I would have to work with others to get back to you on that, to provide the whole picture.
President Morgan, I think the governor's office could be very helpful here. They obviously have a game plan, and they can probably push a few keys on their whatever program they're using and come up with all the places where the TANF dollars go. And then we can look at the various criteria for which TANF dollars are allocated. I mean, it's amazing, I can tell you. You'd be surprised what TANF dollars have been used for. Almost nothing to do with the original intent, and I'm not saying necessarily in your department, but certainly in this legislature. So we can get that. If you can get that for us, I think the committee is asking you to go a little bit beyond your own department, but it would be helpful, I think, because we need to understand the relationship to the whole budget. Does Representative Madore, did you raise your hand? No, that was before. Okay.
You made my point.
I wanted to ask a question about one of the requests that in the governor's budget, which is the cancer surveillance system. And we've had a chance to talk a little bit about the cancer surveillance system privately, and I'd just like to bring it forward on the public record. I have some big concerns with how shallow that cancer surveillance system is. And, let me just ask you to say, what does a person find in terms of data if they were to go on the website and look at the cancer surveillance system? What is available? What data is collected by Minnesota's cancer surveillance system? Looks like you're looking to somebody you might be able to tell us.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Mary Manning, Director of our Health Promotion Chronic Disease, who oversees our cancer surveillance system, to respond to that.
It's on the budget, governor's budget changes, and the pages are page 95, I believe. Let's see. Yeah, page 95 in the budget book, starting actually page 94. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mary Manning, Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease. In the cancer surveillance system, what is reported to us is the type of cancer that the person has, and they report it in what's called a pathology report. It's the type of classification that comes from the pathologist. In addition, we get information about the birth date of the person. We look for some of the information on treatment is collected, and address, residence. Those are the types of things that are in the surveillance system.
And just to be clear, in terms of address, the cancer surveillance system, how far does it go in gathering the addresses or previous addresses of anyone who's had the misfortune of ending up on that register?
Not previous addresses, Madam Chair.
Only the current address.
Correct.
So anyone who has cancer and may have been lived in some part of the state or country where there were possible exposure experiences, there'd be no tracing of any of that. Is that right?
No, that is for the surveillance system. Now, what the surveillance system is used for is it is used by researchers for specific purposes to investigate something. Like, one study that's going on right now is a study that the university is doing. And it's a study looking at associations with farming exposures, non-sterile, anti-inflammatory drug use, and genetic markers. The university is doing a study on those things. They will get permission from the patients or the doctors to talk to the families. And in that type of study, the researchers will go in with that study protocol in mind and find out those types of factors. But the surveillance system itself has to do that.
So just to be clear, if the university or anybody else was trying to study, you know, you said agricultural exposure, they went to Minnesota's cancer surveillance system, they would only find the address of those people who are living in the rural area now on the date that they had their pathology report turned in. Is that correct? There's nothing that tells that researcher whether or not someone lived in a rural area before, grew up on a farm, was exposed to anything. None of that is gathered in this current registry. Is that right?
That is correct. But what the researcher would probably be looking at is cancers specific to the type of thing they want to study. So they will mine the cancer surveillance system for the types of cancers they want to study.
Let me just try to be a little clearer. And pardon me for being a little personal. I am. My name is on that cancer surveillance system. And when I asked my oncologist, where did I get this cancer? One of the things that he suggested was that perhaps my growing up in a rural area had something to do with it, on a farm where I played with DDT, for example, as a child.
Mm-hmm.
There is absolutely nothing in our system right now that tracks any of that, that would even tell a person that a person had lived in an area where they might have been exposed to an agricultural pesticide. So what I'm saying is, and this is not new information to the commissioner or anybody, we have had bills before this legislature for more than 20 years to try to start having some epidemiological information, environmental information. And this department, and this particular branch of this department, has continually testified against it. And I know that you're saying the University of Minnesota might try to send people out to do interviews, but I can tell you four different times the bill's been brought forward, and Commissioner, I think I've talked with you about this personally. We'll do it again this year, and hopefully there'll be a different response. Hopefully the information that will help individuals know, help our researchers make connections, will start to be part of what you can look at and what any researcher can look at. So I'm just concerned about this, and I think, you know, when we're being asked to spend, I don't know how. What's the request for this update?
$2 million.
How much?
$2 million.
$2 million. We're being asked to spend $2 million. We're being asked to spend $2 million to update a system that doesn't collect basic data. I think, you know, we have to look at it. So if we were going to actually spend that kind of money, I would actually want it to be a really good system, and I hope others might consider that as well. That's my. Representative Lane, do you have a question?
I just want to take a moment to thank you for bringing the family home visiting program to our attention as part of the governor's proposal. It is a part of my bill, House File 595, which may end up in this committee eventually. My bill also includes a voluntary newborn visiting service. I mention this because it was in the Star and Tribune in Catherine Christian's column, roundly condemned, and I want to point out that it is both in this part is in the governor's budget, and the other part is a voluntary newborn visiting service. So you may hear more about this later.
Thank you, Representative Swales.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank the Department of Health for your responsiveness to the situation in Woodbury with our drinking water. And the public forum that we had last week was excellent. I think it was 4 hours of wonderful information that you provided to our community. But at that time, the cancer surveillance program was mentioned. And I think that there is a concern among the public or a misunderstanding perhaps or a misperception. A lot of people that night testified, a lot, maybe three or four, who have a particular type of cancer. I thought it was ironic that these same people mentioned the same type of cancer. There is, I think, some real cause for concern. So first of all, does the surveillance program identify cancer clusters? If so, what constitutes a cancer cluster? And how do we help assuage the feelings and concerns of the public so that we can use this information in a very productive and helpful way?
Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Van.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm actually not sure exactly what technically constitutes a cluster, but we definitely do identify clusters, and we look at them and try to look at it seems like a strange term, but what's the normal incidence of a certain type of cancer. And so in the, I think Representative Clark knows that, like, within the arsenic triangle, John Solar came out and spoke with folks out in that area because there is a higher incidence of cancer in certain areas right around Little Earth and the area of the arsenic triangle. Those are the types of things that that they do once we see one. And then oftentimes there isn't anything that more investigation has to keep. It's something that needs to be studied ongoing. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Kind of, sort of, a little bit, maybe. Just know that we do have a lot of citizens right now where this is a hot topic. And I think that we need to address it in a proactive and positive manner. I think we need to document when we hear these people say, I have this particular kind of cancer. We need to seek them out. And I also think that we need to make sure that physicians are reporting the diagnosis to the health department so that we have a clear-cut system of monitoring those diseases as they occur. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, we can certainly get to you the definition of cluster, so, and you know, you have a sense of label, for lack of a better word, and what we mean. I think that would be helpful probably to you and also to the constituency as you interact with them. But certainly that is one of the concerns as we look at the situation down in that area that we are very aware of and trying to be helpful with information, always wanting to provide accurate information so that we are not exacerbating a situation. So I think it would be important for us to be able to get back to you with that definition and then where that definition can lead. So that in fact, if we do begin to see a preponderance, we have an ability then to kick it into further study. But I do think we have to be very clear on the fact that we need the accurate information so we are not, I know no other word, but exacerbating, you know, concern and hysteria when in the face of science, we have to be accurate.
Just one more comment, and that is, that evening I heard several people say, to me personally and a couple of them publicly, would you like to take a sample of our blood to test us? And the response was no. And I continue to get those questions. Can you give me a nice way to address that so that it's consistent with your policy?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative, help me flesh out a little bit the question.
There were citizens at the forum related to the tainted water with the PFBAs, and they said they would like to have their blood tested or some sort of a test to see if there are levels of PFBA in their system. Do we just say, no, the test is unnecessary? I'm looking for a constructive response I can give to my constituents.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm going to have to get back to you. I don't know the scientific tests, from a health care perspective. I know the science type of testing that goes on in a lab around water. I don't know about the blood testing, but I can get back to you on that.
Mr. I just want to make a comment because it was the arsenic triangle was brought up in my community, and I just want to reiterate, and this is to Representative Wells too, if the data is never collected, and the people who lived in your community and have moved on, if the data on cancer, for example, is never collected by asking questions of where have you lived in your life, all the different times of your life, we will never know if people who lived in your district who developed cancer in a couple of years, whether or not it could possibly be related to that. So, if we don't have good data in, we're not going to get good studies out. And good, whether there are cancer clusters or not, you have to have the information to make any sort of determination. And that's what good science would require, that we actually have some very thorough data. I want to ask a question about the arsenic triangle since you brought it up. One of the concerns in my district is, again, this for folks that might want to know, we have an arsenic pesticide all over South Minneapolis. And it's because there was a pesticide plant located in the heart of what is now a very low-income community. And for many years back, starting in the 30s, when this pesticide that was used to kill grasshoppers along the railroad tracks and elsewhere was allowed to blow all of the neighborhoods, it's now, in the last four years, come to bear that many of us have very serious contamination of our yards. I happen to have had my front yard removed down to 18 inches at my foundation because the people from EPA came in their white suits and said, you can't live here unless we take this off. So that kind of concern, is really deep in my community, I have to tell you. And the thing that's so difficult is that the science here is really constantly changing. And I just heard again from one of my constituents who talked about the fact that in our residential area, they're only removing this soil, this contaminated soil, if it's 95 parts per million or above. And yet our EPA has a level that says, in fact, this is the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, states that arsenic contaminated soils at levels greater than 30 parts per million, 30, not 95, 30 parts per million, pose an immediate health threat, particularly to sensitive populations such as young children, pregnant women, and elderly individuals. We have lots of those people in our district, and I guess I'm continue to be very concerned that the health department and the EPA and the PCA and the Department of Ag and all those people who are supposed to be working together to look at these issues are not agreeing on what is the acute level at which we should be protecting the public health of the people living near this former pesticide plant. So I'm just going to lay that out there. I don't know if you have any comments. It's not new information that people are very, very concerned. People ask me all the time, should we get our blood tests? Should we get hair samples? Most of them cannot afford it over a period of time. We have fees that we do not now have a public health department that provides access to this, and health insurance and even clinics have either refused or say they don't know how to test for arsenic. So this is a concern, and I think maybe we'll have to revisit these issues because we're running out of time today. But I do want to say that it is a deep concern to me about the varying levels that your agency, as compared to the federal agency, as compared to the other state agency, PCA, have around advising people of their public health exposure here. And I guess I'd just ask you to get back to me. We're low on time, but if you have any comments that you can make right now, just around this arsenic level, the disparities in information, it would be very helpful for me to be able to take that back to my district.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I do think that what we need to do is get back with you on information on this, and we'll do that quickly and timely.
All right. And we may, you know, we can have a hearing if we need to talk about some of these issues. We have some time, and we'll have actually probably some evening meetings come up. I just wanted to let you know that Representative Medora has a question, and Representative Anderson. Anderson, I think you were first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manning, how long has the Division of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease been in existence?
4 years.
So that's the explanation, Madam Chair. Ms. Manning, that's the reason that the short-lived history on some of these colorectal and cervical and breast cancer has been established. Has there been, you mentioned in your report here that you've had some collaboration with other other partnerships with public and private agencies. Is there more information that could be brought in from other agencies so that you deal with in a maybe a private situation that could help give further information further back in time regarding some of this areas of concern?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, the Division of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease has been in existence for about 4 years. I'm sorry, the Cancer Surveillance System has been around longer. It's been around since 1988.
Okay. Thank you.
And Representative Medora.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just also wanted to add, as you were talking about cancers, we also have the same issue in the autism community. And that long-term research, trying to figure out where people were raised, when their diagnoses were made, and that sort of thing. So I'd like to encourage you that if you're going to host that, we could also look at adding new disorders to the surveillance team so that perhaps we can get some better information so that in the future we can make better decisions on how to address this community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Important comment. Let's see. We have the minutes before us for the 20th. And for the 14th, excuse me, the day of the 20th, for the 14th. Representative Swales, if you had a chance to look at those minutes, and could you move that they be approved, if so?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the previous minutes.
Okay. Is that a motion to approve the minutes of the 14th? All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are done. I think we're done for today. Committee members, please watch for some evening meetings. We are going to have some, and we'll try to do our best to coordinate with all of you. And Representative Stevenson, I want to ask you to specifically meet with me if we have some concerns from your caucus so that we can try to get everybody's schedules in line. Good job with that. Okay, the meeting is adjourned.